Film City Video. This is Russ.
Do you have that one with that guy who was in that movie that was out last year?
Hello and welcome to the Emerald City Video Podcast. This is Russ Burlingame, and with me today is Zach Roberts.
Hello, hello, hello.
And this is Snyder Cut Month. If you don't know what Snyder Cut is, you probably are not living and breathing geek media nonstop like I have to. Zack Snyder directed the recently released Justice League movie. You can find a link to our episode covering that movie in the show notes. He also directed Man of Steel and Batman v Superman. The Man of Steel movie did all right with critics, very well with audiences, got him the sequels. And then Batman v Superman did much more poorly with critics and still pretty well with audiences, and it made money, so they let him do Justice League. Justice League has fizzled on all fronts, and one of the things that happened along the way is that Zack Snyder left the project. He turned in an assembly cut of the movie, which Warner Brothers told him needed a lot of work, and his daughter had recently committed suicide, and so he left the project in order to spend more time with his family, and he left it in the hands of his friend Joss Whedon, best known for directing The Avengers and creating Buffy the Vampire Slayer. When the film finally came out and was a disappointment, a lot of the people who have been big fans of the DC movies up to this point, who actually enjoyed Man of Steel and BVS, essentially got up in arms and said it would have been a better movie had Zack Snyder's cut been released rather than doing significant reshoots. And so we are now living in the world of people doing nonstop petitions and protests and all other manner of things in order to try and get Snyder's cut of Justice League released. And the way that we are able to kind of speak to this in some small way is that Snyder has made, I think, 8 movies, and four of them have extended / unrated / director's cuts.
Yes.
So we are going to try to look at, between now and February 13th, I think it is, when Justice League comes out digitally, as many of these as we can. We are going to try and get all four done, which is still an admirable goal, but that would involve doing 2 per week. And up to this point, we've had some scheduling problems and have not gotten this one done until today. Yeah. So the first thing we're going to be talking about is Dawn of the Dead. And the idea here is that we will look at the theatrical cut, look at the Snyder cut, and determine whether or not Snyder having his kind of final cut over the studio mandate is something that significantly improves the film. In the case of Dawn of the Dead, and we are going to talk about the films themselves in each of these cases, although probably when we get to Batman v Superman, we'll do a lot less talking about the movie because we've already talked about it for something like 8 hours.
Not so sure about that. But
what would be an original thing is if we actually just talked about the film and ignored the public response to the film, because every time we'd start talking about Batman Superman, we get tied up in the whole Rotten Tomatoes of it all.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Literally and figuratively.
Yeah. But in any event, the first thing we want to talk about is Dawn of the Dead. And I think the first thing we should do is probably do a general autopsy on the film, and then we can get into what changes the Snyder Cut makes and how that affects the viewing of the movie. Yeah. Because the one thing I will say that's kind of spoilery is that with Dawn of the Dead, it is far and away the least impactful which cut you watch.
Yeah, by far, yeah.
So, I mean, Dawn of the Dead, if you haven't seen it, is a remake of the George Romero movie by the same name. It changes a lot of elements, and so it's one of these things that is not a straight remake so much as a reimagining or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the big things that it changes is that the main character is Sarah Polley's Anna, and you have a female point of view character for this. This is something that I think Snyder will return to over and over again, because he really likes his kind of badass warrior women.
Yeah.
But, you know, she wakes up, she's a nurse, she works at like a double shift, goes home, has a little bit of friendly banter with the neighbor girl, has a little bit of friendly banter with her husband, wakes up the next morning, and the neighbor girl is a flesh-eating zombie who has broken into their house and murders her husband, who then becomes a flesh-eating zombie as well.
Yeah.
And Anna has to flee. And within about 10 minutes or so of the beginning of the movie, finds herself at the shopping mall, where essentially they use the fact that, like, there's supplies in there, there's fortified doors, there's a lot of space, blah, 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 so that there's a number of people who, you know, take up residence in the mall searching for shelter.
Yep.
First of all, Zach, what's your kind of overall opinion of this? Because it's been probably 5 years since I watched this prior to the podcast.
It's it's weirdly, I think I've seen it on TV a couple times since it, you know, whatever, since it not only it came out, obviously that was, 14 years ago now.
Yeah.
Jesus, 2004. I mean, it's kind of amazing to think that, is this like really the first, did this come out, this came out after or before kind of the zombie, the slow zombie, kind of takeover of modern media, right? I mean, I'm trying to remember, compared to 28 Days Later, when did 28 Days Later come out?
I believe it was 2012. I think 28 Days Later came out shortly before this one.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was,
it wasn't the first, but it was the first, like, American blockbuster.
Yeah.
You know, because with 28 Days Later, it did pretty well in the U.S., but it was still, like, a low-budget foreign film with a bunch of actors nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah. I loved it in theaters. Our mutual friend CS, I think liked it because he's a huge Romero fan, like diehard Romero fan, like has the autograph photo on his wall, sort of fan. and I'm only kind of slightly kidding about that,
I mean, to be fair, I have my autograph Bill Pullman photo on my wall.
Well, that's different. That's different. Especially considering I believe it's from Zero Effect, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. So it's not from any film that anyone's actually seen, you know, of Bill Pullman's. It's from our mutual favorite film of his.
Yeah.
But I usually don't like I don't like Romero's zombie films usually because they're not good. I mean, like, they're enjoyable in the way of like trashy horror film, trauma sort of stuff. But technically in writing and everything like that, they're just not good. And I've always thought that, you know, because of the political and social everything, you know, the actual thing, like zombie films always had a great thing to talk about, you know. And that movie, you know, in the original one is stunning in it's the fact that, you know, talking about, you know, the fact that they place it in a mall and it was, but just the fact that it's not a well-made film is kind of always kept it to the side, you know. It's never been, it's not great cinema. I mean, neither is Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead either,
right?
But it's not great cinema, but it's a solidly made film, whether it's the theatrical release or the uncut version, or the unrated, I'm sorry.
And by the way, because we own the unrated version that has been widely available for about 10 years now.
Yeah.
We actually have, there is a third version of this movie that is also unrated that was just recently, like within months of now, released by Shout Factory on Blu-ray. It's the first Blu-ray release this movie has ever received. And the only difference between the unrated version that we own and the unrated version that Shout Factory just released is there is a scene when Anna is leaving her development where there's like zombies all through her streets and such.
Yeah.
There is a naked woman zombie who in the unrated version, when she steps in front of the car, her breasts are obscured by blood that's smeared on the windshield.
Yeah.
And in the Shout Factory unrated version, which was the like European version. She walks through the frame and there's nothing covering her breasts.
Yeah.
So there's actually a third version of this if you buy it on Blu-ray.
Of course there is.
But I would probably hazard a guess that unless you actually want to own this film on Blu-ray, there's no real benefit to getting the exact same movie, but with boobies.
Which there's, you know, I mean, there's a bit of that in the unrated version that's available on like Vudu and Amazon and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, I mean, as I was saying, I mean, like this, it has a solid script, which should note by someone, ironically, who's not DC, but.
Yeah, you know, James Gunn, the writer of the Guardians of the Galaxy films.
Yeah, so I mean, it, which, you know, is early, which I actually didn't know that literally until I pulled up IMDb just for reference points.
it's one of those things that, because when people take aim at Snyder, Gunn is a person who has been, like, he's not exactly a cheerleader. It's not like they're best pals and whatever. But Gunn has been known to defend Snyder's DC movies. And a lot of people are just like, oh, that's only because you know him, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. They also share Tyler Bates, the guy who does the score for most of Snyder's movies.
Yeah.
Did the score for the Guardians of the Galaxy films. And I believe Super.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, which is, you know, when you start to think about it, it's also that the fact that this uses the way that it uses music and everything like that. Also, it's interesting because it does a lot of things that Dawn of the Dead does a lot of things that Snyder doesn't do in any other film that I can think of. Mm-hmm. And that partially is because you couldn't have like fun, you know, pop music in 300. You couldn't have that, you know, like,
you could, but it would be the Night's Tale thing.
Yeah. I guess Sucker Punch does that. But still, like, the, you know, I mean, like, one big thing I still love about this, I think he officially introduced me to Richard Cheese, yes, who's the fantastic, if you hear the Get Down with the Sickness, the kind of piano bar music version of it, which I highly recommend his music. You guys should check it out if you're not familiar.
He's in Lounge Against the Machine.
Yes, Lounge Against the Machine. And I mean, the overall film, it does everything that the original does, I think. And I'm sure I'll be raked over coals for saying that. You know, but it does it in a more fun way. So
I would agree with that. The one thing that and it's been a while since I watched Romero's, but I feel like Romero had the same thing that Network had, where he was using real products in the backgrounds.
Yeah.
And so you were getting the dual thing, kind of like in Josie the Pussycats, where you have the product placement, but also the commentary on the concept of product placements.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And they very pointedly don't do that in this movie.
Yeah.
There's a shot of a can of Spam and everything from the color scheme to the design, like, it is recognizably a can of Spam, but it's called Smeet.
Yeah.
You know, the store, the sporting goods store, I can't remember the name of the sporting goods store that you see, like, you see the name of the sporting goods store about 130 times because it's on signs all over the place. It's on the exterior of the mall and the establishing shot of the mall. And in the script, they refer to it as Metropolis. And that's not the name that's written literally everywhere. So I assume that the name of the sporting goods store that's written all over the mall is actually the name of a sporting goods store or of that sporting goods store.
Yeah.
And that, for whatever reason, Snyder decided to not refer to it by the real name, but they didn't CG it out for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But so to me, it was an interesting choice that, because the commentary on consumerism is such a big part of what people praise about the original.
Yeah.
I'm really intrigued by the fact that Snyder's version elects to genericize almost all of the products that exist in the film.
Yeah. I mean, I assume that's because of how much more Romero's version was a bit more guerrilla.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And it's and budget and wise of the, once you get into a large, you know, done by a studio and done by the whole, you know, done by everything, then everything is has to be there, which I you know, it's, if you're making a statement about social commentary, unless you're, I'm sorry, Josie and the Pussycats, I would assume it's relatively difficult to, at least in a what's theoretically going to be a large budget film, to kind of like actually have the actual placements. I mean, I don't know how necessarily it works too well, but I think everything works because it's, you see, I think that almost everything in the mall is recognizable to, well, it's that kind of store.
Yeah.
But also I don't think that it harps on, because of just where they are in the placement in the mall, it doesn't harp on it the same way I think that the original, my remembrance of the original did, because there wasn't, which has a lot to do with just the differences in malls, like the way that malls are from the 70s to now.
I also think part of it is the fact that because Romero had slow moving zombies, I remember the original Dawn of the Dead as having more zombies in the mall.
Yeah.
And so you got the imagery of the people, the zombies shambling through the mall, and then kind of the commentary that came with that.
Well, yeah. I mean, the big thing is, if I remember correctly, the original had it was just a two-level mall that had the open space between, and you could actually look down, as opposed to this mall, which there was literally an elevator.
Right.
And although it's a little weird now that I think about it, it's like, wait, how did they get, but there had to have been escalators and there's a whole thing, but it's a very different mall. Like the mall in Dawn of the Dead, or Snyder's Dawn of the Dead, is basically your kind of modern mega mall. And, you know, and I'm trying to, what is it, in Mallrats, what do they describe the dirt mall? Yeah. It's kind of the other one is the old mall that people used to go to or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And Mallrats, of course, is a great example because the Eden Prairie Mall is the one that they shot the actual Mallrats film in. Yeah. Even though it's presented as like the nice mall in town.
Yeah.
That mall is actually the dirt mall because it's like half an hour from the Mall of America.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's just, I found that to be an interesting kind of digression in the sense that the idea of like consumerism or mindless consumerism is simply not a theme that Snyder particularly cares to explore.
Yeah.
And I do think because, I mean, you're right, like as a technical filmmaker, I think that Romero is often found wanting. It's the way that he uses his ideas that made him relevant.
Yeah.
And so I think that the fact that the original was not a great movie but had some great ideas behind it makes it interesting when you remake that movie and decide to eschew those ideas.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it's, I mean, also it also speaks to the fact that you know, I mean, I don't think he deserves as much attack on it as Snyder does, but I mean, he's very much a style over substance kind of guy. And you know, I mean, like that's what 300 is. I mean, 300 is 150% style and fuck all substance.
Yeah.
I mean, because I mean, I don't think that the film necessarily calls for needing much more substance. The film is what it is. But all of his films are, the style so often gets in the way of everything, down to the point where like actually making the film so dark you can't see things and stuff, things like that.
Yeah.
Which again, you know, we're both huge fans of, at least I'm a huge fan of Batman versus Superman.
Yeah.
Much less a fan of Justice League. And I'm one of the people that would sign that petition if I signed petitions to get a recut, because I think actually it's the Whedon filler because I love Whedon, but the combo does not work. So,
it's a weird,
But yeah,
but yeah, I, I agree completely in terms of the Snyder thing. It's actually funny. There's a great breakdown of 300 from Dan Olson, the guy who does Folding Ideas.
Yeah.
Who he, most famously, he's the guy who did that like autopsy style takedown on the editing of Suicide Squad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he has a really great bit about 300 where he basically, he's like, this movie is ultra violent, misogynistic, Eurocentric, blah, blah, like goes down the list of all the problems with like 300 as a cultural artifact.
Yeah.
And he's like, and I love it because it's just the right amount of dumb and fun.
Yeah.
And that's that, that's pretty much, that is a lot of Snyder's work in a nutshell.
Yeah.
And I mean, I say that with love, because again, I like about 80% of what he does. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting though. I think that Dawn of the Dead is a very interesting arc, because it's before he got the complete, and I don't think he's an auteur. I mean, but before he got I would assume almost complete control over his films. Cause I mean, I can't imagine a studio allowing him to go full Snyder on the film, you know,
yeah,
in the way that he did. So I assume that after this film, and I'm trying to quickly checking what
300, I think was the second one.
300 came, or no, it was, wait, was it Sucker Punch? Oh no, no. What? Wait,
Sucker Punch was after Watchmen.
Yeah. No, I'm just, oh my God. Either, Sucker Punch was 2011. But it's just, I thought it was Dawn of the Dead and then 300, then Watchmen. But I mean, he clearly had some, I think at least I would assume he had some like studio heads, or he had some control in the fact that at least he had a reference point that he had to go from. And which I think a lot of his, as you go through progression of the films, you can kind of see Sucker Punch. I don't know. Did he have any control over that? Which is why that movie was such a shit show, even though the idea there was kind of interesting.
I still, I it's on our list of Snyder Cut movies, but I have not seen that film at all.
I think I literally saw it. I think I saw it in the theaters. And then I might've seen it once when it came out on DVD. And then I don't think I've seen it since.
I know a bunch of people, like the hashtag Snyder Cut people who got excited when I started tweeting about doing this month.
Yeah.
Really dig it. And I guess that makes sense because I believe it was the first film he did that was an original idea and not an adaptation.
Yeah. It'll be interesting because I don't believe I've seen I don't think I've seen director's extended.
Yeah. Whatever
version. I think I've only seen the theatrical version, which was kind of a shit show. In the, like, what is going on? Sort of just so much style, so much, whatever. It was like 300, but with, girls in short skirts, like in cosplay outfits, basically. I haven't seen this film in like 7 years, so I apologize to the Snyder fans. I mean, I love Zack Snyder, but my remembrance of that movie is I think been probably tainted by the discussion of the film since. But it's interesting because you have a lot of you know, directors that have such a specific style, and if they don't have somebody, Scorsese is somebody that I always think of, is that you look at his early films when he didn't have a huge budget, he didn't have all the stuff, and they're fucking fantastic, you know, his early work. And personally, and I know 98% of the internet will disagree with me, personally, the last 20 years of his films, maybe, maybe 10 years, have been complete shit to me. Like, they've literally just been recycled ideas of previous films. I mean, Departed was basically like, I haven't won an award for everything I've done since. Let's make everything I've done before that in one film and get every big name actor in Hollywood in literally one film, and let's do that. Hollywood gave him an award. But I am curious, like, with this, because I think that this, it shows a lot of the edges of him, some of the directing, some of the style, you know, cinematography and things like that. But it doesn't have any of the like craziness of, you know, even Batman versus Superman or Man of Steel and Sucker Punch. But yeah, I hope maybe his next film that he does, which according to IMDb is Justice League Part Two. interesting.
Yeah, they announced that they officially made an announcement that that was happening back when they announced the DC film slate.
Yeah.
And by the time JLA was even in production, he was telling people on the set, like, man, I don't know. I think after this, I'm going to need a break. I don't think I'm going to do part two. And then as the movie drew closer and he left it and there were reports that it needed significant reshoots and blah, like it became increasingly clear he was not going to be doing the second half long before the film was actually in theaters. But, and that was, I think, and again, I don't know this, but I believe that was part of the reshoots was making something that was more closed ended so that a part two wasn't strictly necessary.
But so it'll be interesting what his, you know, his next project is to see if whoever the studio is or whatever is going like, okay, so we're going to have to put some constraints on you. And likely he's going to have constraints because he's not going to have a Justice League budget. He's not going to, you know, I mean, the at least according to IMDb, the next film announced is what looks like a small film called The Last Photograph.
I believe that that's a thing that he's like self-financing that he put on Vero or something like that. He's been talking about and sharing behind the scenes stills on Vero.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that movie is going to be like a $30 million budget is what I heard. And again, that might literally just be my brain. Cause I think $30 million was the budget for Dawn of the Dead. But I believe it's going to be a much more modest film and a much more like Zack Snyder showing you that every Zack Snyder movie doesn't have to look like a Zack Snyder movie, which would be a good thing. Like in general, even though I like Zack Snyder's aesthetic, I do think if he can make a movie that doesn't feel like another Zack Snyder movie,
make a movie for the budget of removing Superman's mustache.
Yeah. Exactly. one thing I will say, I was pleasantly surprised by the performances in Dawn of the Dead when I finally kind of got a chance to go back. I knew that I love Sarah Pauly. I kind of like, I'm glad that she's turned into this kind of great auteur and advocate for women's rights in Hollywood and all this kind of stuff. I do kind of wish that she still acted occasionally because I think she's great.
Yeah, I agree. No, but this film really made me. I'm trying to remember what the film was beforehand. I swear. Oh, Go, of course.
Yeah.
Go. No, I mean like so Go and like she's one of those actresses. At least obviously, Existence was great too. At least in the time, I have to rewatch it. It's great now. Like that era in film was kind of weird, but. Is Existence the one with like there's like a weird worm or something? I'm trying to remember what it. Yeah, no, it's just like when you can make films like that. And but she's damn fantastic. And I agree with you. I wish and she the fact that she led this film so well with Ving Rhames, a name even at that or especially at that time, you know. And I'm trying to think of who else, you know. But I mean, like
there were a lot of. There's a lot of actors in this movie that aren't necessarily like stars, but they are the kind of people who steal every scene they're in.
Yeah.
Ty Burrell, who is in that sitcom I don't like that everybody else likes.
Modern Family, yes.
Thank you, yeah.
Which again, if you haven't seen, you have to have seen Modern Family because it's on every single channel all the time.
Yeah.
but he probably is making more money on residuals that every day than the budget of this entire film.
Yeah.
That's why I think one of the reasons when I first watched Modern Family and I'm like, wait a minute, I recognize this guy.
Yep.
Wait, what? He's the dick from.
Yeah. Well, and I remember when I watched this the first time, his dickishness was just so off-putting to me and so annoying.
Yeah.
And then when I saw him in Modern Family, I was just like, okay, just fuck this guy. And I've seen him in a few other things since, and I really liked him. And I think that may have softened me to him when I rewatched Dawn of the Dead. Yeah. But I really was impressed by how much I did not want him. Like, you hate him in the sense that you're supposed to hate him.
Yeah.
But as I was watching the film, I didn't constantly just want him off my screen in the way that I remember wanting that the first half dozen times I watched this movie.
Yeah. No, I mean, his character is just so over the top and so continually dickish. But which is kind of one of the things where I'm like, I guess it's mandatory in a zombie film that you have to have that person. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many people like that has The Walking Dead killed off?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, the completely selfish. It was just like, it's so, except, you know what, in a zombie, in a real sort of situation, that's the guy that lives. You know, that like, that's the guy that not only lives but becomes president after post zombie happens. But but which is something, but I mean, but it's,
well, I will say though,
I
will say that there's an element of, like, you're absolutely right for the most part. Yeah. But I do think, because he is like one of the least physically capable of all of the people, that his death ultimately makes sense, because what he was doing is textbook right for a zombie movie. Vehicle crashed, the other people were hurt, he's getting the fuck out of there with some supplies.
Yeah.
It's really just the fact that he was A, taken by surprise, and B, unable to properly respond to the attack that made him. But in all other ways, this movie pretty much does prove you right. Like, every time he does some selfish, stupid thing, it benefits him right up until the moment it doesn't.
Yeah. Which is just the standard zombie film thing. But it's the only one death, and I assume we're not doing spoilers here.
It's
the only one death that I wish that was actually like fully on screen. which is interesting. You don't get for this film the satisfying or not, depending on, you know, what the character is, zombie deaths in the way that most zombie films you get. Like,
they do a lot of like bottle episode kind of stuff where it's like they mostly want to hear the characters interact. And so you get a lot of these things where somebody gets bit off screen and then reveals their injury at some later point,
which in itself is interesting, because it allows what kind of zombie fans talk about the big plus of zombie, it's not about the zombies, it's about the humans, you know, which is what Walking Dead claims to attempt to do, when it just makes everything more fucking boring. But allowing that to happen allows basically every single zombie situation basically to turn into what does being human mean? Which is again kind of the zombie world, you know, the idea behind zombie films, and the whole now literature and everything behind it now, entire financial system that probably has a gross national product larger than small nations. Based on the fact that there is a Walking Dead Jenga, Walking Dead Jenga, guys. That's how crazy this is.
I think that's actually literally true. I feel like 2 or 3 years ago, I remember writing an article that was literally like, the amount of money that AMC has made from The Walking Dead was more than the budget of, and it was like some small state or something.
Yeah. But it's that the way that they do this, and I think that this is, you know, not only a combo of Zack Snyder directing, but it's a real, you know, it's so... it's so James Gunn. Like, it feels like now that I have learned that it's James Gunn that wrote this, I'm like, it makes a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of tiles that snap into place.
Yeah, and it is like, there's not any like particular thing. It's not like, you know, there's no cool Guardians type character or something like that. But you're like, he has like the people in this film in particular have a humanity that is very distinct to his films. You know, even in, there's a lot, I mean, there's a lot of love in the humanity in 28 Days Later. Wait, is it 28 Days Later or is it 20? What's the first one?
28 Days Later.
28 Days Later, yeah.
Yeah. The second one is 28 Weeks Later, and the Sandra Bullock movie is 28 Days.
So confusing.
And yes, just because it's the kind of thing that everybody has always wanted to do on a podcast, one of these days we are going to do a 28 Days, 28 Days Later double feature.
I am totally down for that. Because I actually weirdly enjoy both of those films. But 28 Days Later has a ton of, you know, there's fantastic. You really feel because it's such a smaller crowd. Mm-hmm. And 28 Days Later, there's like four or five people that actually interact with for most of it until towards the end. But like almost immediately, like the way that they set up Sarah Pauly, like character, I care about her. You know, she's a nurse. She's stressed out. I mean, like, you get her. There's assholes all around her, and she's just like gently dealing with them. And you can already tell, like, she's as the lead. She's gonna be a very good, leader within this thing. Yeah. And then same thing with all the characters at some level. That the character development. Because obviously no one else really gets the sort of character development that Pauly does. Right. But you care about them all in one way level, obviously outside of, Modern Family.
Yeah, they're fairly, for the most part, everybody's fairly fully realized in the sense that even if they only have like three things that you actually know about them, at least one of those things is sympathetic and interesting and something that you want to know more about and all that kind of,
Like Jake Weber, I like Jake Weber as an actor, plays Michael. But in this film, I think that this is like his, because I was re-looking through his, because he's that, I don't, it's not a B, it's like the back kind of like third tier character that you see in a lot of TV shows and films, like and things like that.
I think if he wasn't in that movie, that guy who was in that thing, he should have been.
Yeah, exactly. He's like the third guy that you go to after like three or four other actors, and you're like, well, if I can't get this guy, I can't get it'd be good. Yeah. And it's too bad. It basically just ends up meaning that he never gets that role. Oh yeah, he's in Hell on Wheels. That's where I actually most recently saw him in. He like his character alone, you almost know he got divorced.
Yeah.
At least once. Is there like anything else like failed at being a husband? Like that's it. But like,
well,
I care about him.
Yeah. I actually thought one of the more powerful moments in the movie was the revelation that he had kids.
Yeah.
Mostly just because it came so late in the movie that it was by this point evident that everybody anywhere close to this area was dead.
Yeah.
And so when they were going around talking about the best and worst jobs they ever had or whatever it was. Yeah. And he said, he always thought he was good at being a dad. There was just no response by anybody else in the film. Yeah. And I thought that was kind of the perfect moment because it left this pregnant pause for the audience to kind of realize the implication of that line of dialogue.
It's past tense. And and the fact that he's the only character, I believe that, there is no, I need to get somewhere. Ving Rhames, I need to get somewhere. There's all these people that know, have an idea of where they're going to go to or care about, there's something else going on. Mm-hmm. But he is just, he's already done basically where he is.
I agree. I liked him a lot. One thing that I thought was really interesting, they did a very good job of giving a sense. Like one of the things that they do in the end of this movie that I really do not like is the mid credits coda, like all the home video stuff. And I think I've talked about this before that like, it's kind of ironic that with Man of Steel and with Batman Superman, there was always the like, oh, is there going to be a post credit scene? Cause Marvel does post credit scenes. Are you going to do a post credits? And people complained that there wasn't one and that there was no like setting up the next installment.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I look at this movie and I'm like, yeah, I don't like his post-credit scenes because if there's one thing I thought that I liked better in the Romero version, and there are a couple of things that I like a little bit better in the Romero version, but the big thing to me is the ending, because at the end of the Romero version, it's gloomy and it is unlikely they will survive, but it is left ambiguous, and the audience is able to kind of hold out hope.
Yeah.
This movie very effectively, it is about the end of the world. Yeah. Like, there is no hope in this movie in a lot of ways. But yeah. While they're in the mall, they talk about, you know, early in the movie even, there's the conversation about, like, your mom's dead, your sister's dead, that fat chick from the yogurt place is dead.
Yeah.
And periodically, when they have a quiet moment and they have a conversation, they're already talking about the world in the past tense. And everybody has pretty much accepted that we're staying alive as long as we can, but there's nothing on the other side of this.
Yeah.
And so the fatalism in this movie is kind of paid off by those post-credits things. And so I understand it thematically, but it still just annoys me every time, because I'm just like, you know, just let me have like 30 seconds of, you know what I mean?
Yeah. See, it's funny. I mean, I kind of agree. To an extent, I just wish they would do the film in the film and then the credits happen. I just got out of Spielberg's The Post, and it was actually thoroughly enjoying just walking out of the theater when the credits started.
Yeah.
Like, not everybody be like, are they gonna come back? We're gonna find out. But anyway, but
Woodward and Bernstein are gonna show up in the end credits.
I'll tell you about something off camera, because it's actually kind of weird. But it is I wish they would just finish it. I personally, though, I like the fact that this film doesn't set up essentially a sequel, it doesn't set up a whole world, that world building. Now that, for fuck's sake, I mean, like, I usually don't complain about this, because if a film's good, I'd like to see more. John Wick ended. That was a great ending. You didn't need to continue it. But when I heard there's going to be a John Wick 2, I was like, fuck yeah. You know, and now that John Wick 2 ended, it was a good end, and somebody said there's a John Wick 3, I'm like, I'm fucking awesome, let's have 7. You know, as long as they're good films. But like, I like the idea that you could tell another story from this world. You could go to the mall that was, you know, in the next town over, and cover and do a film from there. But like, this is done. Like, they end this film. The boat is basically completely fucked. They're at a pier, and they have basically opportunity to run into water or get eaten by zombies. Yeah. The only thing that pissed me off is that I'm pretty sure the dog dies. And the fact that it survived all the way to the end.
I don't know. Cause I mean, they did establish in the mythology of the film that nobody, like, the zombies don't care about the dog.
But I don't know. I just get the fact that it's established later on, but they've done that in a bunch of zombie films where, like, certain animal, like, oh, animals are just fine. Yeah. But then it gets to a certain point where they're like, fuck, I don't care. It's moving. I'm going to kill it. That's how bad they are. And this weird group of zombies that are on this island, you know, I think that they're past that point. But also the fact that we don't see the dog running back in, or the barking stops and things like that. I don't know. But anyway,
one thing I think is interesting about this that we haven't kind of touched on yet is that the zombies in this film, like, there was a lot of discussion about the fact that it was fast zombies, which, of course, just 28 days later just happened, and that was beginning to be a thing.
Yeah.
But even more than that, the zombies in this movie retain some kind of much more in the way of kind of hand-eye coordination and some basic instincts than I think you see in most zombie movies. Certainly in the Romero movies up until like Land of the Dead or whatever it was, when he brought back the franchise 20 years later. But like, I'm watching this movie, and some of the things that happen in this movie, you're just like, man, I don't see that in most zombie movies. And like, one of the big moments in this movie that I always remember, I feel like most people probably remember, is the moment when, and of course now I can't remember the name of the guy who owns the gun shop, Andy.
Oh yeah.
When Andy comes up on the roof after having been bit, and he's writing on the whiteboard and they're like, what's it say? What's it say? And then he holds up the whiteboard and he's blood, a zombie and he's just smeared it with blood.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, wait, the zombie climbed the stairs so he could go up and smear blood on the whiteboard?
But that's the whole, but I mean, the whole bit is, and the whole thing about it being in the mall is repetition. And the fact that he just spent what the past month or whatever it is
right.
doing that one thing. So that's what the zombie went back and did. I mean, obviously it's a joke. It's a joke.
Right.
But I personally think it's, yeah.
That's what I was going to say though.
Yeah, okay.
It pays off something that has been like, cause that line of dialogue, when the zombies all start moving towards the mall, early on, I think Michael asks, like, why are they coming here? And somebody says, I don't know, instinct.
Yeah.
And I believe that line was in Romero's, or something very close to that line was in Romero's.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they certainly have that discussion in the original about why people are coming.
And so as much as it's weird for a zombie movie that they look at, there's certain things that strike me as weird because, like, you see the zombies who just run right into the guns. And so they clearly don't have anything in the way of reasoning skills. But at the same time, like when CJ throws the propane tank out into the crowd of zombies, that one zombie picks it up and is clearly about to try to throw it back at him. And so like you get weird moments like that where it's like, oh, that's interesting. But I do think that as much as it seems weird for a zombie movie, it's justified in universe because in both the original and then in this one, they have that line of like, well, they're doing this because somewhere in like the buried animal part of their brain, this is just a thing they remember doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember when I always remember the scenes in the trucks. That was like a thing there in the buses.
Yeah.
And that was a thing that I remember really being a major set piece in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, I remember some of the shots from within there and all that kind of. And I'm kind of, as I'm watching the version, or as I'm watching it again, I'm like, man, that really didn't take any time at all. That wasn't really a big part of the movie. It was just a thing that was kind of visually interesting that other movies hadn't really done.
Yeah, no, it didn't. I mean, it's I had the same exact feeling where I was just like, I remember a lot of time being spent, but in actuality, what was that? Probably like 8 minutes.
Yeah, probably. And that includes the like montage of armoring the trucks.
Yeah. And I mean, especially like I remember the chainsaw thing specifically because not only because I just going immediately like, oh,
this is a terrible idea.
Seems like a really good idea. But to quote a different zombie film, you know what? That's a bad idea because it's obviously a bad idea.
Yeah. It's one of those things too, where you're just like, you're watching it and you're going like, you're in a moving car.
Yeah.
Like the one and only time you should be starting this chainsaw is when it's already pointed out the gap.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, or in general, when you're outside of it, because it's just in general, like, I mean, I get the concept of wanting to be able to do that, but because that's how this whole thing gets stopped up. Like that's actually, you know, I think Z Nation, something like that has happened before. And, you know, cars just get stopped. You think you can just plow through them, but obviously eventually.
Yeah. When there's just an ocean of bodies. Yeah. They did a really good job because I think this is early CG. And so most zombie films up to this point had not had the opportunity to like, there were like 20,000 like zombies swarming the buses as they, and it's like, I don't think I'd ever seen prior to this movie, a group of zombies that big.
Yeah.
Because presumably 80% of those were just CG and nobody else at that point probably had the money / technical ability to just do zombies on that scale.
Yeah. There wasn't a film before that had, I assume that actually be an interesting thing to look up and see whether, if
at the time, this was the most zombies ever. Yeah.
Well, even that, just the budget for a zombie film. And cause I can't imagine, I can't think of another, zombie film that
would have cost $30 million.
Yeah, that would have had that budget because I mean, basically most zombie films, right, are Romero, like before this.
Oh, but even I mean, you had Romero. You also had them. You had a lot of, like, there was an army of Romero imitators, especially you know, obviously there's the trademark issue with Night of the Living Dead, where it's public domain and has been since the first time it was screened.
Yeah.
Just backing up for a second, because I say that and then I realize most people probably don't know this kind of weird trivia. When the movie was made, they had a different working title. I can't remember what the working title is. And in the Indica at the end of the credits, they failed after changing the title to change the copyright information. So Night of the Living Dead, which is the movie that invented modern zombies, because obviously prior to 1968, zombie movies were like African mysticism and voodoo and things like this that weren't what we think of now as zombies.
Yeah.
But the like flesh eating, shambling zombies, the reason that people could immediately start making knockoffs is because the studio neglected to properly copyright the movie, and literally it became public domain, I think, immediately.
God.
And that's, yeah. Think about, like, really think about that. Like, the insanity.
Whoever failed, I mean, how much money, whoever failed to do that.
Oh my lost God. For the studio, yeah.
Lost for, like, everybody involved. You know, oh, yeah. Romero is probably like, you fucking son of a bitch, I could have owned a fucking island.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And it's one of those insane, like, the first time I heard that, I'm like, that can't be true. Like, that kind of error can't actually result in this. And then I, like, went online and did some research, and it's like, no, that's a thing that happened.
Yeah.
Actually, originally, The Walking Dead was going to be called Night of the Living Dead. Just because Kirkman believed at the time that using the well-known trademark would be something that would attract attention to what is a self-published black and white indie comic.
Yeah.
Okay. And so he thought, like, you know, that way I'll get an extra few thousand orders on the first couple of issues, and it gives me a chance to get off to a stronger start.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who, somebody at Wizard or somebody at Image Comics talked him out of it. I don't remember how they talked him out of it or what their logic was, other than just, oh, you know what it was? They eventually persuaded him that if this does become something, if you ever sell this, you would not be able to capitalize on the success of your comic by making a TV show, by selling t-shirts, blah, 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 because every bootlegger in the universe would be able to just take your stuff.
Ah, the George Lucas selling points and the fact that, you know, merchandising. Exactly. And by the way, I should correct myself. And again, this is the sort of like zombie questioning whether, you know, there's all the different types of zombies. It's not straight Romero zombie. Resident Evil came out before.
Oh, this. Yeah, that's right. That's
so
right.
There have been huge numbers and everything like that. And, you know, so.
I never think about Resident Evil when I think about zombie movies. It's just because it's like a weird dystopian future, and it's a video game movie, and it's got all the weird mutant stuff that isn't strictly zombies. And and I know I'm technically wrong. That's definitely a zombie movie. And in terms of the classification, but I never think about it.
I mean, technically, I think CS, our dear friend, would disagree that Resident Evil is not a zombie film, because it is not, because it is actually, I believe, a genetic modification sort of thing, at least within the movies. Yeah. I don't know about the video game itself, but within the movies, it's a genetic modification virus type thing. It's not even per se a virus. It's actually like a genetically modified virus. So I don't think it's technically in the world, even though Google and Wikipedia and everybody else list it. It's not like, you know, I Walked with a Zombie or Return of the Living Dead and things like that.
I actually just yesterday spoke with Johan Erb, who is an actor who appeared in the last two, I think, of the Resident Evil movies.
Yeah.
I don't know who he played. I haven't seen the last two of the Resident Evil movies, or if I did, I just, you know, but, he's on Arrow. Now he plays Vigilante, and I interviewed him. And so it's just interesting to end up in that conversation. And I told him the story of how I was the one to break the news to Mila that they were already remaking, like, literally when she was doing press for the Blu-ray, for the last movie in the series. The day before I interviewed her, they had announced that there was.
I know that because you asked me, is there anything you'd want to ask her? Because I'm a huge Mila Jovovich fan.
Yeah.
I said, well, you should ask her about this. And I sent you the link. And
yeah. And when we got, when I actually asked her, she was like, wait, they're doing that?
Oh, it's just.
Well, why don't we move into kind of the discussion of the Snyder Cut of it all? So the extended cut, unrated cut is technically what it is referred to as on the DVD and on our Vudu account.
Yeah.
What did you think of the unrated cut, Zach?
Well, I mean, my whole thing was, the unrated cut is all that I really remember because, I mean, I saw it in theaters, but I immediately bought the unrated cut on DVD when it came out. I think I still have my the original copy I bought.
With the Emerald City Video stickers on it, probably.
No. I think I actually paid like full price and everything for that one. Nice. Because I remember loving the film rewatched the original, I don't really notice that much of a difference.
No,
I thought that there, I distinctly think, remember, at least I remember thinking at the time that there was a difference. Then actually sitting down, I rented the original, or the theatrical and then within like one day, and I literally had like a notepad open.
Yeah.
Just next to me. So I could be like, oh, 28 minutes in and describe the scene.
Yeah.
And I just literally just watching it like 24 hours after watching the other one, didn't notice any difference.
I think, and I might be misremembering, because again, I did the same thing. I rented the theatrical because I already own the unrated. I believe that the unrated version is like 7 minutes longer or something.
Yeah.
But as far as I can tell, that 7 minutes comes from like 120 shots that just go on for 4 seconds longer.
Yeah.
There are a few things, that are in the film that like stuck out at me. Like there's a shot of the zombie in the broom closet at Metropolis.
Yeah.
And like he gets up and he's got way, way more like intestine visible than I remember from the original. There's a shot when Steve is having anal sex during that like montage of everybody doing stuff and like he's videotaping himself doing it. And I'm pretty sure that I could be misremembering, but I think that in the theatrical cut, it was cropped tighter, so you couldn't see breasts. And as a result of the tighter crop, you also couldn't see for sure that he was recording himself. It just was implied.
Yeah.
Whereas in the unrated version, there's definitely breasts, and there's definitely, like, yes, this is definitely being videotaped. And as I said, there was the scene of the lady, like the naked lady who goes through. And I believe that when I read about that Blu-ray where it's like, oh, yeah, and in the Blu-ray, she's, like, in the Blu-ray version, you see all of the nudity.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I remember reading in that same story that in the unrated or that in the theatrical version, she does not appear at all.
Yeah.
Like that in the theatrical version, she just wasn't in the shot. In the unrated version, there's the blood obfuscating her on the windshield. And then in the Blu-ray edition is the like actual like Snyder uncut.
Yeah.
But yeah, I this is as I kind of led with the beginning of the thing, like if you don't, you know, if for whatever reason you're like, man, I just don't want to buy a digital copy, I want the DVD.
Yeah.
And the only DVD you can find is the theatrical cut, you're fine.
Yeah.
Like you're not actually going to miss anything that has real value. There was some commentary on the internet, like an old DVD review from when it first came out, that intimated that there was a longer sequence that better introduced the second group of survivors that came in the truck.
Yeah.
So that they were less just like straggling in one by one and more introduced. And I read that review in between watching the theatrical and then the unrated.
Yeah.
And I don't recall that being the case. So I could have missed something. But
you mentioned that before I watched either of them, and I don't remember seeing either of them. that. And
And I think this is what I was thinking of before, but one thing I did kind of like at the beginning of the movie when Michael picks up Anna, and I can't remember Ving Rhames' character's name, when he is arguing with them about going to Fort Pastor.
Yeah.
And they say, Michael says something along the lines of, we just came from there back when there were eight of us. And, you know, at this point, there's three of them. There's him and then the married or the couple.
Yeah.
And when they get to the mall, between them and the security guards, there's now eight of them. And then there's another, like, I can't remember if there's eight people who come in the van or if the addition of the van people makes it eight.
Yeah.
But the group of eight going down to three is actually a weird repeating pattern in the movie that happens at least twice, I think three times. And then obviously at the end of the movie, there's more than three people left. And so it's not like, I don't know that it was necessarily an intentional thing. It might've just been a throwaway line of dialogue that I then watched for, but it was a weird, like the group of eight going down to three was like a recurring motif and like groups of eight were a recurring motif. And I don't really know why. so that was a thing. Another thing I should mention, weirdly, there's the father-daughter group who come in. Nicole is the girl's name. I can't remember her father's name, but they're in that truck.
Yeah.
And he comes in and his hand has been bitten. First of all, that girl, her name's Lindy Booth. She appears on The Librarians right now.
Yep.
And
also in Kick-Ass 2.
Oh, nice.
She was Night Bitch.
Oh, cool. I did not know that. I
just made that connection now because I remember watching Kick-Ass 2 and being like, she looks really familiar.
Well, the funny thing about it is that I watched this movie again and I was like, holy shit, she's great in this. Yeah. Like, she gives a fantastic performance.
Yeah.
And so I went to like follow her on Twitter and I realized like, oh crap, she's in, you know, she's in The Librarians.
Yeah.
And the night that I like followed her, her directorial debut was airing on TV. So apparently she is now also a director, which is just one of those kind of cool random things where you're just like, huh, okay, that the timing of that couldn't have been better, because like she doesn't seem to tweet much, but she was tweeting a whole lot when her directorial debut was happening.
Damn, she has done a lot. Check out her IMDb page is like for she's done a lot of work and a lot of films. I mean, I haven't heard a lot of them,
her dad. Oh God, I can't remember his name. He's a character actor. He's been in, again, a million things. He was Moloch in the Watchmen movie that Zack Snyder produced. But appearing as Moloch in Zack Snyder's Watchmen.
Frewer.
That's right, Matt Frewer.
Yeah.
Matt Frewer. Appearing as Moloch in Watchmen was not his first role in a DC Comics movie. He plays a random motorist who attempts to rape Supergirl in the 1984 or whatever Supergirl movie. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Which was one of those weird things that I don't think I processed at the time. And then I watched it again for this podcast when Wonder Woman came out. And I was just like, wait, did somebody try to rape Supergirl? Mm-hmm. It's like that Lindsay Ellis video where she's talking about Transformers and she's like, wait, did Bumblebee pee on John Turturro? No, that obviously couldn't have happened.
But, he was also in the 96-97 Incredible Hulk series. So,
nice. I didn't know that. But yeah, he's great.
Iron Man. Wait, how many comic book movies has this guy been? TV series in 96. Yeah, I was going to
say, he was a voice actor in the TV series.
Yeah.
And I think a Justice League character or two as well, because he does a lot of voice work.
Yeah.
But
honestly, where I recognize him, he was in The Stand. That's actually where.
Oh yeah, that's right. Man, he's Trash Can Man. I actually
remember him always from. But anyway, sorry.
See, I always remember him from. And I don't know if it came before The Stand or if I just saw it before The Stand.
Yeah.
But he was the next door neighbor on Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
No, actually, the way we all know him, he is Max Headroom.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Shit, that's right.
Fucking I totally hell. Forgot about my God, I forgot about that. Shit.
Yeah. Now I got to watch that broadcast takeover video.
True.
But yeah, so anyway, Matt Frewer is a guy who you should know and whose name I shouldn't have blanked on for a minute and a half.
One more thing. He also is in The Meaning of Life. He is the cornered executive who jumps from the building.
Oh, man.
Holy shit. That's like his second role ever. But anyway, continue. I will stop just reading off his credits. But this is the guy. He's literally the guy who's like, he's that guy in every single film.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I mostly just wanted to point out that like, these two characters who came in, they didn't have a ton of screen time, but like I thought Lydia Booth gave just a heartbreakingly good performance.
Yeah. Especially considering her, like the character, what her job was to set up all these. She basically kept being the person who set up her father having to be shot. So there, mm-hmm. She didn't set that up, but she was the crying girl where something was going to go bad. And then she set up the whole scene chasing after the dog where a lot of shit was going to go bad. Like usually you fucking hate that character. I mean, at least personally, like it's like why I can't stand Carl. And or at least used to can't stand. I mean, I assume he's dead or dying, in Walking Dead. But I'm like five seasons behind.
I think he's got like 3 weeks left. Oh. Anyway.
but usually hate that, and she was able to pull it off. I mean, be sympathetic, and yet still, you know, didn't try, you know, play off. And
again, a lot of that goes to the James Gunn of it all, because when she started freaking out about her dad, just that like Matt Frewer's line about how like guys give her a break, you have to understand she's lost everybody, and I'm all she's got left. It perfectly complemented the performance that Lindy Booth was giving.
Yeah.
But on top of that, it then kind of justified when she got kind of irrationally attached to the dog.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just like, I'm an annoying person who's making poor decisions. It's like, I'm a desperate person who has lost literally everything, and you're not going to take my fucking dog.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it was one of those, they did a really effective job, I think, of justifying her motivations in the script, which is something that, as you say, that character a lot of the time has no justifiable motivations and you just hate them.
Yeah.
But again, like I really liked both of their performance in this. I like Frewer just in general as an actor, but I thought Lindy Booth was like probably the most underrated part of this movie because she gets so little screen time that I think most people, when they talk about this movie, probably don't mention her at all.
Yeah.
But I remember even like being, you know, 24 or whatever I was when the movie came out. And my biggest takeaway from her was like, wow, she's super hot.
She's adorable, even though she's actually older than both of us,
playing the 17-year-old at age 30.
It's actually something, and I think we've kind of like walked around it in this whole thing, is that this Dawn of the Dead, it plays on all of the tropes that we know now within zombie films and zombie TV shows and zombie whatever the fucks, and does them all pretty well. And it's not just zombie films, it's any horror film where you're being chased, you know,
or survival horror.
Yeah. And every single, outside again of Modern Family, who I think that he's the only one that kind of walks that edge, but he just plays it so well. To his credit, to the actor's credit, the fact that he's able to play a and I know you don't like the show, but a normal human being that's like everybody on the planet loves
play
this obnoxious fucking asshole who is every person you fucking hate.
Yeah, I totally agree.
But still play it realistic too. He's not just over the top ridiculous. You're like, no, you go, no, I can see a good percentage of the people, you know, that you run into at any mall or any out in society acting exactly like this. This is not usual zombie film over the top ridiculousness. This is like within the world, which again, directing and also script there. But still, like, he's so easily could play just a complete fucking dick that you hate him, which he does, but to the point where you, like, I don't want to deal with it. I don't like the film because of it.
Yeah, exactly. He walks that line really effectively. I also think, and in terms of screenwriting, the guy who has the most complete arc in this movie is actually CJ, which is kind of incredible. Like, the first time you see him, he's literally waving a gun in Anna's face, and he's a totally irredeemable fuck, and he has to essentially be pressured into doing, like, not even anything remarkable, just, like, the fundamentally decent thing of, like, not kicking the main characters back out. Not even allowing them in, because they're already in.
Yeah.
It's literally, he has to do absolutely nothing, and it would be more work for him to kick them out, and he wants to do that more work just to hurt people because he's that selfish.
Yeah.
And you have to, like, when you first meet him, that's where he's coming from. And he has to be talked into doing, like, the decent thing. And then in, you know, that to me, when he sits there and goes, shit, and intentionally makes the decision, like, he's going to blow himself up to save the people who are still left on the pier. It's like that is such a, they built a really complete character arc for this character who in most other movies would be like the throwaway douchebag.
Yeah. And I think that I don't see that as so when, at least in the film, and it's kind of to me kind of hard to explain why, like, but they're able to through little things, and just the way the character's acting, like, I don't see that as there's no fucking way, you know, like, there's no, obviously also the out is it's not just him being, you know, very helpful and doing
suicide. He's gonna die anyway.
And he's like, obviously I think that it within the film and all within it, kind of in every way, it leans towards a little bit more like not having to do with selfishness, but more towards fuck those guys, I'm gonna take some sons of bitches with me. Sort of thing. But yeah, no, I mean, he's definitely the guy you want to die first in this film. And he's literally one of the last.
He's the last like main character who you actually see die.
He's the last on screen.
When Michael dies, it's implied that he died because it's the off screen gunshot. And then, like I said, everybody else, it's the like mid credits, like home video thing.
And you never actually see him.
Yeah, you never see anything happen.
Again, it's just implied that they all die, but we all kind of anyway.
I think a lot of the time when I think back to my Emerald City Video days and I think about these movies that I've seen dozens of times, because they just came out at that right moment when we were doing nothing except watching movies and, you know,
that's changed. No, but anyway,
but I feel like a lot of them do not hold up. A lot of these movies, you watch them again and you're just like, I mean, I see why I liked this, but it's not great.
You still like these films because of the time period and because not because of the film, but because of the things that you attach to them.
This one, a lot of the time, like when you watch those, it almost breaks it. It's like when you watch like some of the objectively terrible like 80s cartoons that you loved as a kid and you're just like, oh man, I can't get through this.
Oh my God. Yeah.
and I've that's happened to me with a lot of movies from like this era, from like the 1999 to 2010 kind of era of like, yeah. Before I had kids, before I, you know, whatever, when the times when I used to watch movies over and over.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'll watch a lot of them and be like, wow, what was I thinking? This one holds up remarkably well. I was almost surprised how well it held up, except for the fact that because I like Snyder and because I like Gunn and because I kind of went in being like, okay, I think I remember enough of this movie. I can't say I was surprised that I still liked it, because I did kind of go in predisposed to like, I'm pretty sure this isn't going to be a mess.
Yeah. Yeah.
But any final thoughts?
I mean, it's interesting because I think that the original film, obviously this is far before, you know, when this film came out in theaters, this is before not only did we really have a strong idea of who Zack Snyder was and what he would become. And that goes kind of either way, whether you like him or hate him. it is interesting because I don't know where I would have as the film either one, because obviously as we've documented, there's not like a dramatic change to the unrated cut, but I don't know where I would have changed anything, extended things or kind of knowing what I know about Zack Snyder now, like where I'm going, oh, I could see there's probably a scene on the cutting room floor, or there's an extended thing, or there's more of this, there's more of that. And also like having the extended cut that is out there now, the Blu-ray version that's out there that has like the naked woman in front of the car and things like that, which all seem to be just kind of sophomoric kind of, this is a zombie film. And this is what, you know, it's the thing that separates to me kind of a more adult zombie film than to the, you know, 8,000, zombie films that come out like every single year now, that have, you know, a budget of $15 or whatever. And so I'm like, I'm so happy that he didn't do that. And I'm so happy it didn't make it into the screen. Cause I mean, I do think that this is one of the films and that really kind of gave the zombie genre, which I kind of begrudgingly love. I didn't really like it before but gave that entire genre, you know, the kind of the adult, the need to for respectability that, oh, these don't have to be horrible, crappy films that you watch only at the rundown theater at midnight sort of thing. This is Cineplex shit. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it made $100 million, which shockingly way back in 2004, that was a respectable dollar amount. The fact this was made in the, you know, mid-aughts and how much has changed since then on what we expect in film, just budget wise and length and everything under the sun. But like I said, thank God it wasn't made in today. And that like it opened up the door for this entire world that we all now have to cover endlessly. but it is nice to see like an early days, a zombie film before now it's become this multi-trillion dollar industry. So
where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me, on the internet. sorry, I make that joke way too often. ZD Roberts on Twitter, Zach D Roberts on Facebook, and you can follow, I'm writing, just about to post tomorrow, a review of, The Post. I finally watched and, hopefully I can drag Russ to go see it so we can actually do a both conversation because it'd be interesting to hear, your take on the kind of journalism, you know, world, as well. And, you can find that at visu.news, visu.news.
And you can find me at Russ Burlingame, RussBurlingame, or ECV_podcast for the Emerald City Video Podcast, which you are currently listening to. Mm-hmm. You should subscribe to us on YouTube so that I can remonetize this. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Emerald City Video Podcast. And yeah, you guys will probably see us back within a week. We're going to look at Watchmen and also the Watchmen director's cut, not the ultimate cut, which is like 35 minutes longer and includes the animated Tales of the Black Freighter footage, per a number of people on Twitter who reached out to me after I posted our kind of teaser for Snyder Cut Month. I was instructed that Snyder considers the director's cut to be quote unquote his version.
Yeah.
And the ultimate cut is a little too extra for Zack Snyder, which really think about that for a minute. But so we'll be back soon to talk Watchmen. Like, rate, review us on iTunes, Podbean, and your podcast machine of choice. Apparently, we are now on Spotify. Thanks very much, and we'll see you soon.
Hey, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. Good to see you, buddy. How have you been? Things have been okay for me, except that I'm a zombie now. Really wish you'd let us in. I don't want to nitpick, Tom, but is this really your plan? Spend your whole life locked inside a mall. Maybe that's okay for now, but someday you'll be out of food and guns. Then you'll have to make the call.